Environmental advantages, argued Gobineau, cannot explain the rise of civilization. For the same kind of environment, for example, soil-fertilizing rivers that watered the civilizations of Egypt and the Near East, produced no civilization among the Indians of North America, though they lived on fertile soil along magnificent streams. Nor do institutions make a civilization, for this has risen under a diversity, even a contrariety of institutions, as in monarchical Egypt and, quote, democratic, end quote, Athens. The rise, success, decline, and fall of a civilization depend upon the inherent quality of the race. The degeneration of a civilization is what the word itself indicates, a falling away from the genus, stock, or race. Peoples degenerate only in consequence of the various mixtures of blood which they undergo. Usually this comes through intermarriage of the vigorous race with those whom it has conquered. Hence, the superiority of the whites in the United States and Canada, who did not intermarry with the Indians, to the whites in Latin America, who did. Only those who are themselves the product of such enfeebling mixtures talk of the equality of races, or think that all men are brothers. All strong characters and peoples are race-conscious and are instinctively averse to marriage outside their own racial group. In 1899, Houston Stuart Chamberlain, an Englishman who had made Germany his home, published The Foundations of the 19th Century, which narrowed the creative race from Aryans to Teutons. Quote, true history begins from the moment when the German, with mighty hand, seizes the inheritance of antiquity. End quote. Dante's face struck Chamberlain as characteristically German. He thought he heard unmistakably German accents in St. Paul's epistle to the Galatians, and though he was not quite sure that Christ was a German, he was confident that, quote, whoever maintains that Christ was a Jew is either ignorant or dishonest, end quote. German writers were too polite to contradict their guest. Treitschke and Bernardi admitted that the Germans were the greatest of modern peoples. Wagner put the theory to music. Alfred Rosenberg made German blood and soil the inspiring myth of the 20th century. And Adolf Hitler, on this basis, roused the Germans to slaughter a people and to undertake the conquest of Europe. An American, Madison Grant, in The Passing of the Great Race, 1916, confined the achievements of civilization to that branch of the Aryans which he called Nordics, Scandinavians, Scythians, Baltic Germans, Englishmen, and Anglo-Saxon Americans. Cooled to hardness by northern winters, one or another tribe of these fair-haired, blue-eyed, quote, blonde beasts, end quote, swept down through Russia and the Balkans into the lazy and lethargic South in a series of conquests marking the dawn of recorded history. According to Grant, the, quote, Sake, end quote, Scythians, invaded India, developed Sanskrit as an Indo-European language, and established the caste system to prevent their deterioration through intermarriage with dark native stocks. The Sumerians poured over the Caucasus into Persia, the Phrygians into Asia Minor, the Achaeans and Dorians into Greece and Crete, the Umbrians and Oscans into Italy. Everywhere the Nordics were adventurers, warriors, disciplinarians. They made subjects or slaves of the temperamental, unstable, and indolent Mediterranean peoples of the south, and they intermarried with the intermediate, quiet, and acquiescent Alpine stocks to produce the Athenians of the Periclean apogee and the Romans of the Republic. The Dorians intermarried least and became the Spartans, a martial Nordic caste ruling Mediterranean Helots. Intermarriage weakened and softened the Nordic stock in Attica and led to the defeat of Athens by Sparta in the Peloponnesian War, and the subjugation of Greece by the purer Nordics of Macedonia and Republican Rome. In another inundation of Nordics from Scandinavia and northern Germany, Goths and Vandals conquered Imperial Rome. Angles and Saxons conquered England and gave it a new name. Franks conquered Gaul and gave it their name. Still later, the Nordic Normans conquered France, England, and Sicily. The Nordic Lombards followed their long beards into Italy, intermarried and vitalized Milan and Florence into a Renaissance. Nordic Varangians conquered Russia and ruled it till 1917. Nordic Englishmen colonized America and Australia, conquered India, and set their sentinels in every major Asiatic port. In our time, Grant mourned, this Nordic race is abandoning its mastery. It lost its footing in France in 1789. As Camille Desmoulins told his café audience, the revolution was a revolt of the indigenous Gauls, Alpines, against the Teutonic Franks, who had subjugated them under Clovis and Charlemagne. The Crusades, the Thirty Years' War, the Napoleonic Wars, the First World War, depleted the Nordic stock and left it too thin to resist the higher birth rate of Alpine and Mediterranean peoples in Europe and America. By the year 2000, Grant predicted, the Nordics will have fallen from power, and with their fall, Western civilization will disappear in a new barbarism, welling up everywhere from within and from without. He wisely conceded that the Mediterranean race, while inferior in bodily stamina to both the Nordics and the Alpines, has proved superior in intellectual and artistic attainments. To it must go the credit for the classic flowering of Greece and Rome. However, it may have owed much to intermarriage with Nordic blood. Some weaknesses in the race theory are obvious. A Chinese scholar would remind us that his people created the most enduring civilization in history. Statesmen, inventors, artists, poets, scientists, philosophers, saints, from 2000 BC to our own time. A Mexican scholar could point to the lordly structures of Mayan, Aztec, and Incan cultures in pre-Columbian America. A Hindu scholar, while acknowledging, quote, Aryan, end quote, infiltration into North India some 1600 years before Christ, would recall that the black Dravidic peoples of South India produced great builders and poets of their own. The temples of Madras, Majura, and Trichinopoly are among the most impressive structures on earth. Even more startling is the towering shrine of the Khmers at Angkor Wat. History is colorblind and can develop a civilization in any favorable environment under almost any skin. Difficulties remain even if the race theory is confined to the white man. The Semites would recall the civilizations of Babylonia, Assyria, Syria, Palestine, Phoenicia, Carthage, and Islam. The Jews gave the Bible and Christianity to Europe, and much of the Quran to Muhammad. The Mohammedans could list the rulers, artists, poets, scientists, and philosophers who conquered and adorned a substantial portion of the white man's world from Baghdad to Cordova, while Western Europe groped through the Dark Ages, approximately 565 to 1095. The ancient cultures of Egypt, Greece, and Rome were evidently the product of geographical opportunity and economic and political development, rather than of racial constitution. And much of their civilization had an oriental source. Greece took its arts and letters from Asia Minor, Phoenicia, and Egypt. In the second millennium BC, Greek culture was Mycenaean, partly derived from Crete, which had probably learned from Asia Minor. When the Nordic Dorians came down through the Balkans toward 1100 BC, they destroyed much of this proto-Greek culture. And only after an interval of several centuries did the historic Greek civilization emerge in the Sparta of Lycurgus, the Miletus of Thales, the Ephesus of Heraclitus, the Lesbos of Sappho, the Athens of Solon. From the 6th century BC onward, the Greeks spread their culture along the Mediterranean at Durazzo, Taranto, Cortona, Reggio Calabria, Syracuse, Naples, Nice, Monaco, Marseille, Malaga. From the Greek cities of South Italy and from the probably Asiatic culture of Etruria came the civilization of ancient Rome. From Rome came the civilization of Western Europe. From Western Europe came the civilization of North and South America. In the third and following centuries of our era, various Celtic, Teutonic, or Asiatic tribes laid Italy waste and destroyed the classic cultures. The South creates the civilizations, the North conquers them, ruins them, borrows from them, spreads them. This is one summary of history. Attempts to relate civilization to race by measuring the relation of brain to face or weight have shed little light on the problem. If the Negroes of Africa have produced no great civilization, it is probably because climatic and geographical conditions frustrated them. Would any of the white races have done better in those environments? It is remarkable how many American Negroes have risen to high places in the professions, arts, and letters in the last 100 years, despite 1,000 social obstacles. The role of race in history is rather preliminary than creative. Varied stocks entering some locality from diverse directions at diverse times mingle their blood, traditions, and ways with one another or with the existing population, like two diverse pools of genes coming together in sexual reproduction. Such an ethnic mixture may, in the course of centuries, produce a new type, even a new people. So Celts, Romans, Angles, Saxons, Jutes, Danes, and Normans fused to produce Englishmen. When the new type takes form, its cultural expressions are unique and constitute a new civilization, a new physiognomy, character, language, literature, religion, morality, and art. It is not the race that makes the civilization. It is the civilization that makes the people. Circumstances, geographical, economic, and political, create a culture, and the culture creates a human type. The Englishman does not so much make English civilization as it makes him. If he carries it wherever he goes and dresses for dinner in Timbuktu, it is not that he is creating his civilization there anew, but that he acknowledges, even there, its mastery over his soul. In the long run, such differences of tradition or type yield to the influence of environment. Northern peoples take on the characteristics of southern peoples after living for generations in the tropics, and the grandchildren of peoples coming up from the leisurely south fall into the quicker tempo of movement and mind which they find in the north. Viewed from this point, American civilization is still in the stage of racial mixture. Between 1700 and 1848, white Americans north of Florida were mainly Anglo-Saxon, and their literature was a flowering of Old England on New England soil. After 1848, the doors of America were open to all white stocks. A fresh racial fusion began, which will hardly be complete for centuries to come. When out of this mixture a new homogeneous type is formed, America may have its own language, as different from English as Spanish is from Italian. Its indigenous literature, its characteristic arts, already these are visibly or raucously on their way. Racial antipathies have some roots in ethnic origin, but they are also generated, perhaps predominantly, by differences of acquired culture, of language, dress, habits, morals, or religion. There is no cure for such antipathies except a broadened education. A knowledge of history may teach us that civilization is a cooperative product, that nearly all peoples have contributed to it. It is our common heritage and debt, and the civilized soul will reveal itself in treating every man or woman, however lowly, as a representative of one of these creative and contributory groups. Chapter 5. Character and History. Society is founded not on the ideals, but on the nature of man, and the constitution of man rewrites the constitutions of states. But what is the constitution of man? We may define human nature as the fundamental tendencies and feelings of mankind. The most basic tendencies we shall call instincts, though we recognize that much doubt has been cast upon their inborn quality. We might describe human nature through the table of character elements printed on the inside cover of this package. In this analysis, human beings are normally equipped by nature, here meaning heredity, with 6 positive and 6 negative instincts, whose function it is to preserve the individual, the family, the group, or the species. In positive personalities, the positive tendencies predominate. But most individuals are armed with both sets of instincts, to meet or to avoid, according to mood or circumstance, the basic challenges or opportunities of life. Each instinct generates habits and is accompanied by feelings. Their totality is the nature of man. But how far has human nature changed in the course of history? Theoretically, there must have been some change. Natural selection has presumably operated upon psychological as well as physiological variations. Nevertheless, known history shows little alteration in the conduct of mankind. The Greeks of Plato's time behaved very much like the French of modern centuries, and the Romans behaved like the English. Means and instrumentalities change, motives and ends remain the same. To act or rest, to acquire or give, to fight or retreat, to seek association or privacy, to mate or reject, to offer or resent parental care. Nor does human nature alter as between classes. By and large, the poor have the same impulses as the rich, with only less opportunity or skill to implement them. Nothing is clearer in history than the adoption by successful rebels of the methods they were accustomed to condemn in the forces they deposed. Evolution in man during recorded time has been social rather than biological. It is preceded not by heritable variations in the species, but mostly by economic, political, intellectual, and moral innovation transmitted to individuals and generations by imitation, custom, or education. Custom and tradition within a group correspond to type and heredity in the species, and to instincts in the individual. They are ready adjustments to typical and frequently repeated situations. New situations, however, do arise, requiring novel, unstereotyped responses. Hence, development in the higher organisms requires a capacity for experiment and innovation, the social correlates of variation and mutation. Social evolution is an interplay of custom with origination. Here, the initiative individual, the great man, the hero, the genius, regains his place as a formative force in history. He is not quite the god that Carlyle described. He grows out of his time and land, and is the product and symbol of events, as well as their agent and voice. Without some situation requiring a new response, his new ideas would be untimely and impracticable. When he is a hero of action, the demands of his position and the exaltation of crisis develop and inflate him to such magnitude and powers as would in normal times have remained potential and untapped. But he is not merely an effect. Events take place through him as well as around him. His ideas and decisions enter vitally into the course of history. At times his eloquence, like Churchill's, may be worth 1,000 regiments. His foresight in strategy and tactics, like Napoleon's, may win battles and campaigns and establish states. If he is a prophet like Muhammad, wise in the means of inspiring men, his words may raise a poor and disadvantaged people to unpremeditated ambitions and surprising power. A Pasteur, a Morse, an Edison, a Ford, a Wright, a Marx, a Lenin, a Mao Zedong, are the effects of numberless causes, and causes of endless effects. In our table of character elements, imitation is opposed to innovation, but in vital ways it cooperates with it. As submissive natures unite with masterful individuals to make the order and operation of a society, so the imitative majority follows the innovating minority, and this follows the originative individual in adapting new responses to the demands of environment or survival. History, in the large, is the conflict of minorities. The majority applauds the victor and supplies the human material of social experiment. Intellect is therefore a vital force in history. but it can also be a dissolvent and destructive power. Out of every 100 new ideas, 99 or more will probably be inferior to the traditional responses which they propose to replace. No one man, however brilliant or well-informed, can come in one lifetime to such fullness of understanding as to safely judge and dismiss the customs or institutions of his society. For these are the wisdom of generations after centuries of experiment in the laboratory of history. A youth boiling with hormones will wonder why he should not give full freedom to his sexual desires, and if he is unchecked by custom, morals, or laws, he may ruin his life before he matures sufficiently to understand that sex is a river of fire that must be banked and cooled by 100 restraints if it is not to consume in chaos both the individual and the group. So, the conservative who resists change is as valuable as the radical who proposes it. Perhaps as much more valuable as roots are more vital than grafts. It is good that new ideas should be heard, for the sake of the few that can be used, but it is also good that new ideas should be compelled to go through the mill of objection, opposition, and contumely. This is the trial heat which innovations must survive before being allowed to enter the human race. It is good that the old should resist the young, and that the young should prod the old. Out of this tension, as out of the strife of the sexes and the classes, comes a creative tensile strength, a stimulated development, a secret and basic unity and movement of the whole. Chapter 6. Morals and History. Morals are the rules by which a society exhorts, as laws are the rules by which it seeks to compel, its members and associations to behavior consistent with its order, security, and growth. So for 16 centuries, the Jewish enclaves in Christendom maintained their continuity and internal peace by a strict and detailed moral code, almost without help from the state and its laws. A little knowledge of history stresses the variability of moral codes and concludes that they are negligible because they differ in time and place, and sometimes contradict each other. A larger knowledge stresses the universality of moral codes and concludes to their necessity. Moral codes differ because they adjust themselves to historical and environmental conditions. If we divide economic history into three stages, hunting, agriculture, industry, we may expect that the moral code of one stage will be changed in the next. In the hunting stage, a man had to be ready to chase and fight and kill. When he had caught his prey, he ate to the cubic capacity of his stomach, being uncertain when he might eat again. Insecurity is the mother of greed, as cruelty is the memory, if only in the blood, of a time when the test of survival is now between states, was the ability to kill. Presumably the death rate in men, so often risking their lives in the hunt, was higher than in women. Some men had to take several women, and every man was expected to help women to frequent pregnancy. Pugnacity, brutality, greed, and sexual readiness were advantages in the struggle for existence. Probably every vice was once a virtue, that is, a quality making for the survival of the individual, the family, or the group. Man's sins may be the relics of his rise, rather than the stigmata of his fall. History does not tell us just when man passed from hunting to agriculture, perhaps in the Neolithic age, and through the discovery that grain could be sown to add to the spontaneous growth of wild wheat. We may reasonably assume that the new regime demanded new virtues and changed some old virtues into vices. Industriousness became more vital than bravery. Regularity and thrift more profitable than violence. Peace more victorious than war. Children were economic assets. Birth control was made immoral. On the farm, the family was the unit of production under the discipline of the father and the seasons, and paternal authority had a firm economic base. Each normal son matured soon in mind and self-support. At 15, He understood the physical tasks of life as well as he would understand them at 40. All that he needed was land, a plow, and a willing arm. So he married early, almost as soon as nature wished. He did not fret long under the restraints placed upon premarital relations by the new order of permanent settlements and homes. As for young women, chastity was indispensable, for its loss might bring unprotected motherhood. Monogamy was demanded by the approximate numerical equality of the sexes. For 1,500 years, this agricultural moral code of continence, early marriage, divorceless monogamy, and multiple maternity maintained itself in Christian Europe and its white colonies. It was a stern code which produced some of the strongest characters in history. Gradually, then rapidly, and ever more widely, the Industrial Revolution changed the economic form and moral superstructure of European and American life. Men, women, and children left home and family, authority, and unity to work as individuals, individually paid, in factories built to house not men, but machines. Every decade, the machines multiplied and became more complex. Economic maturity, the capacity to support a family, came later. Children no longer were economic assets. Marriage was delayed. Premarital continence became more difficult to maintain. The city offered every discouragement to marriage, but it provided every stimulus and facility for sex. Women were emancipated, that is, industrialized, and contraceptives enabled them to separate intercourse from pregnancy. The authority of father and mother lost its economic base to the growing individualism of industry. The rebellious youth was no longer constrained by the surveillance of the village. He could hide his sins in the protective anonymity of the city crowd. The progress of science raised the authority of the test tube over that of the crozier. The mechanization of economic production suggested mechanistic, materialistic philosophies. Education spread religious doubts. Morality lost more and more of its supernatural supports. The old agricultural moral code began to die. In our time, as in the times of Socrates, who died 399 BC, and Augustus, who died AD 14, war has added to the forces making for moral laxity. After the violence and social disruption of the Peloponnesian War, Alcibiades felt free to flout the moral code of his ancestors, and Thrasymachus could announce that might was the only right. After the wars of Marius and Sulla, Caesar and Pompey, Antony and Octavius, Rome was full of men who had lost their economic footing and their moral stability. Soldiers who had tasted adventure and had learned to kill, citizens who had seen their savings consumed in the taxes and inflation caused by war, women dizzy with freedom, multiplying divorces, abortions, and adulteries. A shallow sophistication prided itself upon its pessimism and cynicism. It is almost a picture of European and American cities after two world wars. History offers some consolation by reminding us that sin has flourished in every age. Even our generation has not yet rivaled the popularity of homosexualism in ancient Greece or Rome or Renaissance Italy. The humanists wrote about it with a kind of scholarly affection, and Ariosto judged that they were all addicted to it. Aretino asked the Duke of Mantua to send him an attractive boy. Prostitution has been perennial and universal, from the state-regulated brothels of Assyria to the, quote, nightclubs, end quote, of West European and American cities today. In the University of Wittenberg in 1544, according to Luther, quote, the race of girls is getting bold and run after the fellows into their rooms and chambers and wherever they can and offer them their free love, end quote. Montaigne tells us that in his time, 1533 to 92, obscene literature found a ready market. The immorality of our stage differs in kind rather than degree from that of Restoration England. and John Cleland's Memoirs of a Woman of Pleasure, a veritable Catena of Coitus, was as popular in 1749 as in 1965. We have noted the discovery of dice in the excavations near the site of Nineveh. Men and women have gambled in every age. In every age, men have been dishonest, and governments have been corrupt. Probably less now than generally before.